You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an expert on harassment, online hate, and digital authoritarianism joins the show to make the case that we need to do more to protect democracies from the unique threats of the online era. First, the U.S. continues to deal with the outbreak of COVID-19, a respiratory disease caused by a coronavirus that originated in Wuhan, China, last year. Wisconsin's lone positive case of COVID-19 was cleared last week after the patient was confirmed to be healthy and no longer able to spread the disease. But there have now been a handful of deaths in the U.S. from COVID-19, and three western states have announced possible instances of community spread, meaning it's unknown how the patients were infected with the disease. New reporting from ProPublica shows that the federal agencies handling the U.S. response made crucial early missteps that limited our ability to test people for the disease. Caroline Chen is a healthcare reporter for ProPublica. Caroline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you briefly tell us what kind of tests we're talking about here that hopefully we can use to detect this this coronavirus?
Yeah, so the reporting I did was on the CDC's test kits, which are used to test for the virus that causes the disease, which is known as COVID-19.
And what were some of these early missteps you reported on when it came to getting workable test kits out to the people who need them?
Yeah, so early on at some point in time, which not clear who made the decision and exactly when this was, but the CDC decided to make its own test kit, which differs from the protocol that's used by most other countries in the world, which is endorsed by the WHO. So the American test kit is a different design. And what my reporting found was that early on the design was a slightly more complicated one, and was there were sort of three parts to it, and one part was designed to, you know, find a family of coronaviruses and not just the virus that is causing the current COVID-19. And I'm not really sure why that was, that decision was made. And so if you actually look at the documents that describe the CDC test kit, it describes this portion of the test that's intended, quote, for the universal detection of SARS-like coronaviruses. So this is sort of like the extra bit. And so these test kits got sent out to all the public health labs, so there are about 100 of them, about 4 weeks ago in early February, and there was a problem with this sort of extra bit where a control portion was faulty. And it took about 3 or so weeks before the CDC and FDA decided we're just going to drop that part and basically revert it to a simplified kit that tests just for the virus that causes COVID-19. So a bunch of weeks were lost in that process.
Yeah, if I'm understanding it right, this test did work. It did detect the virus we're trying to detect, but it also gave false positives in that other complicated part that really muddied the waters for these public health testing agencies. Do I have that right?
Yeah, basically. So the protocol was basically like, unless all of these parts, you know, work as intended, we're not going to let you use these test kits. And the sections that were designed to just test for COVID-19 were fine, and they worked as intended, but because sort of this extra fancy bit was faulty, they weren't letting the public health labs go ahead and start using the test kits. But they didn't really need this extra part. And it took them a number of weeks before they finally made this decision, you know, as these cases started popping up. I think that's what really pressured them, you know, along with all these public health labs clamoring, saying, like, we need to start testing, for them to say, all right, drop it.
Right. And the response from the public health labs is a big part of this. Can you talk about what you've heard from these on-the-ground labs eagerly looking for the ability to get early detection of this this looming disease?
Yeah. So another thing that I think we should talk about is testing criteria. So one you know, criticism that has come along from a number of epidemiologists is that for quite some time, until mid last week, the CDC pretty stringently, very stringently, I'll say, limited testing criteria only to people who displayed certain symptoms who had traveled from China. And a lot of epidemiologists and public health officials wanted that expanded to people who had traveled from other countries that also were experiencing larger outbreaks, so South Korea, Iran, Italy. And even further than that, actually, epidemiologists have been wanting to do what's called sentinel surveillance, which is to say, we don't even care where you've come from. We, you know, have the suspicion that community spread is starting to happen, which is what we're starting to see now in the United States, which is cases where we don't know how the person got infected. You know, we don't have a clear travel history. And sentinel surveillance is usually done to start looking out for warning signs. And how that's typically done is, you know, if you have a patient that comes in with respiratory symptoms, a fever, a cough, and, you know, it looks like flu, but you test them and they're negative for flu, then we test them for COVID-19. And the plan is, you know, some cities want to start doing that. And at that point in time, the CDC was saying, you can't do that. You know, we have these very stringent testing criteria. And so there was this clamor, you know, this is, you know, early last week, Monday last week. At that point, it was limited to travelers from China. And slowly, the CDC over the last week has been expanding and expanding criteria, you know, as there's been pressure. But, you know, that's obviously tied to testing capacity. You can't expand the criteria if you don't have testing capacity.
Talking to Caroline Chen from ProPublica, healthcare reporter there, about some early missteps in the U.S. when it came to testing for COVID-19, the novel coronavirus disease. Caroline, that leads to the logical next step. Where are we now? Do we have the testing capacity out there to test everybody we want to test?
Yeah, so things are moving so rapidly on the ground, you know, literally from hour to hour. I have been doing interviews where, you know, I'll talk to someone and an hour later they'll interview me and say, oh, the thing I told you, that's no longer true. So one major change that happened this past weekend is that the FDA decided that they would allow academic hospitals to be able to start developing and using their own tests. And this is a big and important change because that means that we're no longer just relying on the CDC to manufacture and send out test kits. And there are a lot of academic hospitals who have the ability to develop and create high-quality tests. And the FDA is saying, yes, we'll still review them, but you can start using them once you've internally validated them yourselves, and then you still submit, you know, information to the FDA for review. So that is going to really bump up testing capacity. So I expect to see capacity ramp up dramatically. Now, I do want to address one thing, which is I think there are a lot of people who say, look, we haven't seen that many cases yet in the U.S. Like, are we panicking? And I do want to say, I don't think panicking helps anyone. But there was a scientist I interviewed who I think said something that was really smart, which is, like, we need data. And right now the disease is ahead of the data. And we don't know anything if we don't gather information. And so it is important to do testing. And to do things like sentinel surveillance to find out what we know and what we don't know and to find out where the disease is. And it's great if we do some testing, for example, of people who have flu symptoms, flu-like symptoms, but who are negative for flu. And if they're negative, that's good. That's good information that we can get back. So I don't think that it's panicky to do things like sentinel surveillance. I think at this point in time, because there's evidence of community spread in a number of states, that it is a good move to be doing testing.
Caroline, I'll let you get back to changing this fast-moving story. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, I just want to mention one more thing. ProPublica really wants to talk to people on the ground, so that's any medical workers at hospitals, any patients, and we have a call out which is at propublica.org/coronavirus. So if you're on the ground, we want to hear from you. Please write in to us.
That was Caroline Chen, healthcare reporter for ProPublica. You can find the story she's been talking about, key missteps at the CDC. Find it linked at wpr.org/centraltime. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about a unique new doctoral completion program at Edgewood College that lets students finish their education PhDs after encountering some big hurdles along the way. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a dark, icy race.
For 24 years, the annual tradition called Book Across the Bay has brought hundreds of skiers and snowshoers to Shawamigan Bay in northern Wisconsin. The mission? To cross a frozen 10-kilometer stretch of Lake Superior under the night sky. Reporter Eric Lorenzen attended this year's race and brings us this audio postcard.
It's all about what you're doing here on the lake. A lot better than sitting on your butts and watching TV, don't you think?
So here we are on the frozen shores of Lake Superior. We're standing around this bonfire to inaugurate the new ski race. I think we're in for a really fun time tonight.
Well, have a great race.
I'm Ben Thone, and I'm one of the race directors. Book Across the Bay is a 10-kilometer point-to-point event. We like to call ourselves an event over a race. It's really more of a festival or a party that happens to be across the lake. So you're just out there with whatever stars and moon and then the luminaries we've got, which are little candles and lanterns. So it's almost romantic or kind of whimsical.
I am Jack Plasterer from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm going to be doing the classic ski. As much as this is a race, it really is more of a parade, being able to go at my own pace and then also stop at the tents and the warming houses and have chili and hot chocolate. There's just something really cool about skiing on top of a frozen lake. Now, you think that this sort of thing would be kind of scary. Fortunately, it's so thick and there's a good layering of snow that ends up not being much of a worry. But to be on one of the Great Lakes, I think that makes it all the more special because it is bigger and it does make you feel like you can do more than you thought you could.
My name is Kelly Adlington. I'm from Stevens Point. And I don't really ski very much, so I was kind of nervous about being really slow on foot, but it's very nice so far. The lanterns, like the ice bucket lanterns, are, I don't know, separated by like 25 feet maybe down the entire way, kind of like lighting the path so you don't stray too far. It's pretty magical. The sky is pretty clear, which is really nice. You can see a lot of stars. There's some clouds coming in, but everything is really dark, but it's certainly not uncomfortable.
My name is Tom Hinkey. I've been doing it about 15 years. I've never actually done the race myself. I've always been at a rest stop. We're volunteering for Special Olympics. That's what we've done every year since I've, you know, been volunteering. But some nights can be very beautiful if the stars are out. There's been years when it's been very brutal out here also, cold and windy.
You made it. That's huge. That's huge.
I'm Karen Olson from Rice Lake, Wisconsin. It was very long. It was fun up until about probably like 6 kilometers. Then it was a little windy, a little cold, a little dark, but it was still fun. I would do it again, but I'm an idiot, so I would do it again.
This event embodies everything that is northern Wisconsin and in the Shawamigan Bay Area. Volunteerism at its best, family fun. It cures some February cabin fever.
Eric Lorenzen is a writer based in Madison. He attended this year's Book Across the Bay. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, getting a PhD is a big job. It can take years of work before you graduate. It can be easy for a personal emergency or life change to derail that work. But a new program at Edgewood College in Madison lets education students who've had to stop their PhD start back up and finish it. Sarah Jimenez-Sofa is the Director of Research for the Edgewood College EDD program. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us how this PhD completion program works for the people who come and do it.
Sure, absolutely. The purpose of our program is to provide students with advanced graduate work and accredited doctoral programs the opportunity to complete their dissertation and earn their EDD. So we provide ABD, or all but dissertation, students a structured and supportive pathway to earn their doctorate. We emphasize four key components in our program. We have coursework that's specifically designed and focused to help students complete their dissertation. Most of the time when students come, when they leave a doctoral program, they leave because they are struggling with writing the dissertation. Typically, students finish their doctoral content courses, but they don't complete the dissertation. That's the tough
piece. That's the all but part of all the doctorate, right?
That's absolutely true. So we designed our program to be really support focused for those students. We provide research and writing guidance. Each of our students receives a connection with an editor, and that editor works with them all throughout their time that they're writing. And we provide intense one-on-one advising with a full-time faculty member in our program. So students have a lot of support as they go through the writing process.
As I understand it, this could be anything from I was writing my dissertation and stalled to my dissertation program was stopped by a natural disaster.
Yes, exactly. So it's designed to welcome students and to give students a pathway who have completed a significant amount of the work somewhere else and have left for one of any reasons that students leave their dissertation process.
All right. Can you talk about one of your students, I understand, was in Puerto Rico in the midst of a natural disaster.
That's absolutely.
That's a very maybe unique story even in your fairly unique program.
Yes. Arabelle is a teacher at West High School. She teaches social studies, and she's an ELL teacher. And she had gotten through all of her coursework in the University of Puerto Rico, and disaster hit. And she decided at that moment she needed to come to the States. She was hired at West High School and was looking for programs and was very dismayed because many of the programs that she spoke with told her she basically had to start over. So she found us, which was great, and she's I'm meeting with her today. She's actually making great progress and is scheduled to complete her work by May of 2021.
Now, as I understand it, this is not a common kind of program in education or any higher education field.
No. In fact, we're the first accredited program like this in the United States. There are two other programs similar to this, but they are not accredited.
What inspired you to start this at Edgewood?
Well, 2 years ago, the president of the college called for ideas for innovation and impact. So it was a very exciting opportunity to put some of my research into practice. I did a lot of research about attrition in doctoral students, and we know why students leave, and we know how difficult it is for students to be able to return. And so that's what inspired it, and it's really been great. We had 16 students in our first cohort that started this past fall, and we have 32 students that have expressed interest in starting next year.
What do we lose in terms of talent, people who would have that doctorate and be able to do cool stuff with it, when we have that, as you said, attrition, when they don't quite make it past that last hurdle?
I think students, I interviewed a lot of students, potential students who were ABD, and there's a lot of trauma and shame around not finishing. And I think a lot of times students will stop their pathway to their desired goal. There are positions that require a doctorate degree. And so when you sort of fall off the pathway, I just think it's sad for people not to have that pathway to finish.
When people end up with that doctorate in education, what kind of things do they do? I imagine one of the things might be teaching the teachers of the future.
Yes, for sure. So we kind of target two tracks. We have the traditional ABD students. Oftentimes, they work in higher education settings. So we have people who are deans of students. We have the doctoral degree allows people to be able to teach in the higher education arena. We also have superintendents. So the superintendents independent license sequence in the state of Wisconsin is a doctoral level sequence, and some superintendents go on to get their EdD, but some superintendent programs don't provide that next step for them. So for us, being able to welcome superintendents into our doctoral program, and we have a long history of success with superintendents earning their EdD at Edgewood College. I think that's another avenue for superintendents to be able to go on and teach and also just improve their own practice with that doctorate degree.
Is there a thought this will ultimately help develop talent that ends up working here in the state, or maybe even luring people into the state, hoping that some of them will stick around?
I think so. I don't think that's the main goal of the program. Our program is very blended, and we offer online options. So we are spread across the United States. I think for us, it's the opportunity to help people grow in their leadership and improve their practice. But absolutely, especially with the superintendents, most of the superintendents in the state are graduates of our program. So to continue on with that tradition, I think would be wonderful for the state of Wisconsin.
As you mentioned, the first cohort started in the fall. What are you looking for now next year? I imagine you're already taking applications, recruiting students for next fall.
Oh, yes. We are growing. As I said, we have over 30 people that have expressed interest in our program. We are equipped and ready to grow this program. We feel like once the news gets out, the word gets out about the program, it's going to be pretty exciting, and it's going to be very attractive for an option for people.
Could you see this being then a model for other schools around the country?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's lots of degree completion programs out there, but none that focus specifically on doctorate degrees.
Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Sarah Jimenez-Sofa, Director of Research for the new Edgewood College EdD program. That lets students who've had to pause work on their education PhD finish up their dissertation and get that degree. Coming up, a business, technology, and human rights lawyer has some advice for us on protecting our democracy from authoritarians online. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins the program for a look at legal issues around things like vaping, mental health, relationships between the state and tribal governments, and more. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, it's no secret that a lot of bad stuff happens online, from individual cases of harassment to massive campaigns orchestrated by governments or extremist movements. In the early days of the internet, the hope was that it could be a tool of free expression, one that could even help overthrow authoritarian regimes. But now those authoritarian governments have harnessed the power of the internet as an instrument of control, and in many cases, use it to disrupt democratic societies. Our next guest says democracy is under attack online, and it needs defenders who understand what's going on. Britton Heller is a counsel for the law firm Foley Hoag. She's also a technology and human rights fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. She's giving a talk this Wednesday night on UW-Madison's campus, 7 p.m. at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. The title is The Digital Authoritarian's Toolbox, How to Protect Digital Democracy. Britton, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
The digital authoritarians. This is not a household phrase, I think. Who are we talking about?
For digital authoritarians, basically, we're talking about governments and non-state actors who decide that they're going to use disinformation campaigns to tighten control over citizens' data and basically suppress dissent. What this does is it erodes trust in the internet as well as the foundations of democracy.
That's something that an authoritarian government could do to its own citizens. It also is something they might try in other countries, too, a weaponized authoritarianism online. Is that something that concerns you here in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere?
We've seen this phenomenon pop up all over the world. Um, I I personally, as an American, am very concerned about the U.S. elections. But if you look at elections all around the world, especially in the global south, you'll see governments using that as kind of a laboratory to check, see the best ways to reach their goals.
Who are some of the worst cases around the world when it comes to this digital authoritarianism? Who are the worst case stories that we should all worry about?
I tend to focus more on the goals of the authoritarians than on where they're located, because with the internet, they can pop up anywhere. So there's three things that a digital authoritarian wants to do. First, they want to create domestic chaos and fear, and they do this by exacerbating pre-existing social fissures in a society. Second, they try to silence voices and target influencers. And third, they try to leverage or even opportunistically warp the efforts of people who are trying to protect human rights and freedom of expression.
What does that look like on the ground? What would the internet user, first of all, within a country using these techniques, what would they experience and see?
Well, if you look at the Senate Intelligence Committee report that was released in October, it talks about how the Internet Research Agency, which is a troll farm out of St. Petersburg, showed an overwhelming operational emphasis on race in all of the posts that it made on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And the intended goal, it seems, was to demoralize and divide African-American voters and amplify racial tensions in U.S. society. About two-thirds of the Russian activity on social media that was trying to influence the 2016 election was aimed at African-Americans, according to this report. And you can actually see this manifest in really specific communities. Like, some of this activity was focused on Charlotte, North Carolina, where more than a few people in the community were fooled by Russian social media accounts in the wake of riots rocking the city after a police shooting of one of the residents. One of the IRA's most popular Instagram accounts, Blackstagram, attracted 300,000 followers. And they, the IRA also took out advertisements on social media to stir emotions after the police shootings. And one account on Facebook called Blacktivist garnered millions of likes, shares, and comments.
I think in the early days of the internet, Britain, the thought was there's something about this technology that's going to be inherently anti-authoritarian. It's going to put, you know, the control in the hands of people sitting at their computers wherever they are around the world. Have we been slow to recognize the way that, no, in fact, authoritarian governments and non-state actors have used it to their own ends?
I think that this is a very old game, but these are very new tools. So I'm not surprised when I see the type of activity that goes on, like trying to suppress voters. But the fact that you can now shut down the internet in certain areas of the world, and this is commonplace around elections, takes it to a new level.
Talking to Britton Heller with the law firm Foley Hoge and the Kennedy School Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard. She is giving a talk in Madison this week, The Digital Authoritarian's Toolbox, How to Protect Digital Democracy. Well, let's get to the protection side of things. What kind of protections are you looking for here?
I think the number one thing that I would say to people who were worried would be to vote. When you look at the disinformation that is coming out of all of these regimes, they're trying to disrupt the process. And back in 2016, much of the disinformation coming out of Russia was trying to convince people that their vote didn't matter. So by trying to convince people to remove themselves from the process, they were really trying to undermine the way the American political system works. So if you're concerned about it at all, vote. I think you can also try to recognize that the pattern of how disinformation works when you see it on social media. The basic pattern is always the same, and a scholar named Ben Nimmo calls it the four D's of disinformation: dismiss, distort, distract, and dismay. To kind of summarize it, people always dismiss the speaker online, they distort the facts, they distract from the main point, or they dismay their targets to try to silence or stop them from taking action. So if you keep that in mind when you're looking at your social media, think critically when you see political posts, especially around an election.
I talked to Danielle Citron, who has been writing about these issues as well, and she says it's really easy for somebody running a disinformation campaign to win, because they win if you believe what they said, but they also win if you disbelieve it and then go on to lose trust in everything. You get demoralized. How do we defeat something like that, that has two ways of beating us?
I think the point is to be an engaged voter, to learn as much as you can about the issues that you care about, to make sure that the sources that you're looking at aren't just your trusted friends and neighbors, but also scientific evidence, think tanks, governments. Really educate yourself to a variety of points of view before you come to your conclusion.
Now, that's the individual user. How about the platforms, the Facebooks and Twitters and Instagrams and on of the world? Do they have a responsibility to try to rein in these authoritarian efforts?
I think that some of the things that they can do and that they've just started to do now are to basically think about these type of risks in the same way they think about hacking and other cybersecurity risks. So to have a risk-based allocation of resources, look to where customer bases or users are most vulnerable, and this is often around elections or social unrest, and to reallocate a lot of their staff and their resources and their attention there during that time. The platforms will say that they don't have a lot of extra resources, and I think that's actually true, but that doesn't mean that they can't concentrate them when we know that there's going to be a flurry of activity.
What's their incentive to do that? If they have lots of users, if they're making money under the system as it is, what's going to get them to take active measures to counter this kind of disinformation?
I think that people lose trust in their platform when they find that it's been used as a tool to undermine our political processes. One of the things that I think platforms can do is instead of just looking at, and this helps them get around the First Amendment question, is instead of looking at actors and instead of looking at content, to really look at behaviors. And that's something that the platforms themselves have to do because nobody else, not really government without process, not private citizens, not really academics, but nobody else has a window into the type of behaviors that they're seeing on the back ends. And so that is something that they can do. And if they don't do that, the public will lose trust.
We're talking to Britton Heller from the Harvard Kennedy School Carr Center about what tools digital authoritarians are using to disrupt our democracy online. Britton will be giving a talk on this topic at UW-Madison on Wednesday evening at 7 at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how authoritarian movements or governments spread disinformation online? When you're at your computer, at your phone, how do you look out for bad actors, foreign bots, bad information maybe being spread by somebody you know, maybe somebody you know and love? Do you call people out for sending bad information to you? Call 800-642-1234. And have you ever, you know, hit send or share on something and later realized it wasn't true? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation about threats to democracy from some repressive regimes and other actors online. Britton Heller is with us from Foley Hoag Law Firm and the Harvard Kennedy School Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about various entities online spreading misleading false information? How do you spot it in your own online life, if at all? What questions do you have about identifying it and how to react to it? What do you think the responsibility of the Facebooks of the world or governments of the world should be on trying to rein this in? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Dan is with us in Green Bay. Dan, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Dan?
Well, I hate to be a pessimist, but I am concerned that we're a little too late. For instance, you could make the argument that they chose our last leader here in the United States, those folks, nefarious folks out there that are manipulating us like puppets. Also, the things we may need to do, you might not be able to do in a free society. So even if we could, we'd start to look like them. Just wanted your expert's opinion on that.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Let's tackle both of those points. Barn door open, horse is already gone, Britain.
Well, I remember this quote that said that the point of disinformation was not to make people believe what is true to be false, but rather to make people doubt that anything was true at all. So the thing that I focus on is not losing hope and not taking the point of view that there is nothing we can do. The type of research that I've done, I did a study that looked at the online characteristics of hate speech using artificial intelligence with the D-Lab at UC Berkeley. And we were trying to figure out what hate speech looked like when it was directed at immigrants. And the results that came back were actually very surprising. The top four results were black, white, man, woman, and Jew. So it looked rather strange because we thought that anti-immigrant hate speech was going to look like a civil rights violation, like targeted specific hatred at a specific group. But what it really looked like was people basically targeting everyone and trying to stir the pot. So I think that one of the things that we can do to not lose hope is to make sure that we stand up for people who we see being targeted online. And this is because the trolling and online harassment and trying to make Americans hate each other is the ultimate goal of digital authoritarians. And so I'm hoping that horse hasn't left the barn yet, because it's all about basically taking care of your neighbors and reminding ourselves that we're all part of the same community and we sink or swim together.
And Dan's other point, maybe on the landscape of the internet, we as an open society are at a disadvantage. There are limits to how much we want to control things as compared to an authoritarian, say, government. So what do you say to that?
Well, I think if you look at freedom of expression, it's the way it expresses itself in the United States versus the way it expresses itself in Europe or in case law throughout the European Union or around the world. It's freedom of expression doesn't mean that you can say whatever you want. And I think Americans sometimes get confused about that. There have always been limits on freedom of expression. Like, people talk about you can't scream fire in a crowded theater. You can't threaten imminent violence. And so I think that there still are ways that under the law we can look at online speech. I think the more interesting question for me is online speech a little different? Because people talk about you have freedom of speech, but does that imply freedom of reach, right? Because of the amplification problem. So that's something I think that we don't have an answer for yet, and something that I continue to think about.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hello.
Hi. I don't think there's any government that's more pervasive and effective at malicious internet activity than our own. We need to look at the revelations of Edward Snowden and the funding by our intelligence and defense industry in the establishment of Facebook and Google.
Jim, thanks for the call. Jim's saying the United States is not at all blameless here. What do you think, Britain?
Well, I think that looking at shutting down avenues of information and dissent is actually a global phenomenon. And oftentimes you see governments doing this in the name of combating disinformation or hate speech. The Freedom House is an NGO, and they put out a report about the state of the internet. And so during one week in January 2019, there were actually internet disruptions where the governments shut down full access to the internet in Sudan, Ethiopia, Algeria, Venezuela, Liberia, and Kazakhstan. So this happens all around the world, and we haven't really hit that point in the United States yet. So you can kind of see a spectrum when you're looking at access to information, especially around elections. And it goes from turning off the internet all the way to spreading disinformation about where people vote to trying to discourage people from going to the ballot box in the first place.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Britton Heller. She is talking about authoritarian abuses of the internet, misinformation, disinformation, and what to do about it. We asked our listeners to comment with their thoughts on what they see on the internet and social media, Britton, on our Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Chris, who says she tries to check verifiable sources, and she goes on, "I do not trust anything on Facebook at all. There's too much news being based on opinion, not facts and expertise. Rumor is just that, rumor, unconfirmed, and should be reported as unconfirmed." Do we need to distinguish the types of things we see on the internet, rumor, opinion versus reliable news articles?
I think that our commentator is right. And if you look, most people are worried about their data. There was a study that actually came out today from the Knight Foundation, and they talked about how a bipartisan majority of people, 88%, say that their biggest concern is misuse of data. And they say that technology platforms shouldn't provide any information to political candidates' campaigns so they can better reach voters online. And I think that this is interesting because both Democrats and Republicans agreed on this front. When you're looking at sources online, what I tend to do is make sure that the news sources that I'm going to are professionalized news sources. And then you can even take it one more step back and to see where they're getting their information from. Platforms like Facebook actually will have a mechanism now where you can go and you can see what the fact checkers that they've employed say about the sourcing of these stories coming online. But I think the caller seems to have the right impulse to be a little skeptical about the things you see online until you verify, and then you trust.
Is there something about the medium, though, that makes it difficult to do this, Britton? Because, you know, part of the appeal of a Facebook or Instagram or whatever is that you breeze through lots of stuff, get a little taste of lots of different things. We don't really want to dig deeper and take extra time for each and every piece of information we see.
That's part of the challenge of democracy, I think. Democracy takes work. And so if we're interested in the bite-sized, soundbite form of democracy, that's exactly the type of rights we're going to get. So,
in our last minute or so, what's the next thing you're watching for? What's the next trend, either on the interference side or on the defense side of digital authoritarianism?
Two things. One, I look for the mixing of legitimate political expression from Americans with foreign actors. That is something that the foreign actors have been trying to do, where they sort of set the gears in motion and then try to get Americans to pick up the football from there. And that is really hard to do because that creates big questions about freedom of expression and political participation when many people don't know that they are being unwilling accomplices to this sort of thing. Second is I'm looking at hate speech and online harassment that targets minority groups, because that seems to be a very specific tactic to make Americans hate each other. And I see that there's a study from the Institute for the Future about 10 different minority groups being targeted online. And the Oxford Internet Institute did the same thing with gender. So looking at the way we hate each other online and how that is designed to undermine our political processes.
Britton, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
That's Britton Heller, counsel for Foley Hoag and fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. She focuses on legal issues of technology, human rights, and business. We talked to her today about protecting digital democracy. Britton will be giving a talk on this topic at UW-Madison. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a guest tells us there's a loophole in Wisconsin law that keeps records of arrests on people's files even when they aren't charged. We'll hear the case for expungement of these kind of records. A college in North Dakota has official accreditation recognized by the federal government. Just one problem, it doesn't seem to exist. A reporter tells us what happened when they tried to report on a school with no sign of students, professors, or anything. And we can learn a lot about our world from the alternate realities and futures of science fiction. Our guest tells us how the genre reflects and shines a light on the issues of today, and you can share your thoughts. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Stop, Hey, What's That Sound? There's a lot of noise around. Kate's guest says noise pollution is a big problem that doesn't get a lot of attention. Find out more and share your stories and concerns. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, business development in rural areas has lagged behind cities in the years after the Great Recession. But not all rural communities are the same. We'll talk to an economist about the factors that give some areas a leg up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for your support. Did you remember to submit a matching gift form to your employer? You already know that your support helps pay for the great radio programs you enjoy every day. A matching gift from your employer also helps pay for those programs. How great is that? To see if your company matches, go to wpr.org/support and click Matching Gifts. Or check with your HR department. Thanks for the extra support.
Tune in to PBS Wisconsin, Tuesday night at 7, for the premiere of Rabbit Before Horses. Meet Rabbit Before Horses Strickland, a talented Wisconsin artist, musician, and theoretical mathematician whose work reflects the culture of his community. Explore the truly unique world of Ojibwe artist Rabbit Before Horses Strickland, Tuesday night at 7 on PBS Wisconsin.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump says he is not currently considering an emergency declaration to deal with the coronavirus. As NPR's Tamara Keith